I've called my talk tonight The Six Obsessions. The reason will become obvious as we go on. But first I want to ask you a question. Are we normal, do you think, wanting to follow a spiritual way? I think the answer must be no. We're in the minority by a long way. But there again, on another level, yes, of course we're normal, because everyone is looking for something. What is everyone looking for? Or perhaps there are as many answers as there are people. But some popular pursuits are pleasure through the senses, success, typically in business or commerce. Some go for public acclaim. So all kinds of different avenues, entertainment perhaps, politics, media, you name it. Others seek personal satisfaction through helping others. And of course, that most popular of all pastimes, many, many of us seek the perfect relationship. But what are we as meditators looking for? Again, perhaps there are as many answers as there are meditators. But some popular reasons for taking up meditation are to meet the perfect, sensitive and intelligent partner, to increase our pleasure in living, to gain acclaim within the group. Some even take up meditation to be politically correct. After all, everyone is meditating these days, and so you have to as well. And some, of course, take up meditation to gain understanding. We, that is, meditators and non-meditators, seek these things mainly because of dis-ease. We feel unfulfilled, empty, unsatisfied in some way, possibly agitated and uncertain. There is an internal void that demands always to be filled. We feed this void constantly. We feed it with food, work, extreme exercise. We feed it with excitement, romance, success and failure. We even feed it with drugs, alcohol and cigarettes and things like that. Yet, whenever there's a quiet moment, the unease starts up again, and we feel less than we were. Even when life is sweet, how long does it last? Things change, and that bothers some people almost more than anything else. Just when they've got their lives mapped out and know where they are, things go and change again. What is your most common reaction to change? In your working environment, perhaps. Is it always to see the faults in the new system? Or do you embrace it, believing that any improvement is better than none? As a matter of record, today, nearly 25 years after decimalisation, there are still some of us who can't get on with the new money. There are those who deplore the passing of empire, who cannot accept that Britain is no longer a major player in the World League. Nearer home, some reject plans for new housing estates when housing is desperately needed. Some fight tooth and nail against new roads. Many of us fear and distrust change almost as a matter of principle. And yet, paradoxically, we seek change every day, in areas that are safe and familiar, of course. So are we normal? Absolutely. All of us, without exception, seek an end to the inner disquiet. We do, however, perceive the problem, and therefore the possible solution, in very different ways. Some even mistakenly think that their own particular difficulty is unique and incurable. If, as meditators, we find ourselves distressed and desire to alleviate the problem, what can we do about it? The first thing is to be ruthlessly honest about our current priorities. What is most important to us? We should ignore what we think idealistically is the case. What do we actually spend most time and effort on? Trying to fill the void within, we often aim obsessively at things that can only bring pain and grief in the end. The practice of meditation is learning what we do to block the clear light within. And any block always stems from craving and attachment. If we want to erase the void, it is these attachments or obsessions we have to deal with first. In every case, the underlying attachment is to self. At the time, the individual sees himself as the center of the universe and perceives everything through a screen of intense self-concern. To find out if you sometimes suffer from this problem, ask yourself these questions. Do I believe that the world owes me something? And do I believe that my meditative progress is the highest priority above all else? And when things go wrong, is it always somebody else's fault? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then if you really do want to end the unease that brought you to meditation in the first place, you need to learn compassion, humility, self-discipline, and that truly horrific word for Westerners, obedience. This will bring balance and open up pathways to freedom currently closed by clinging and attachment. The best way to tackle the problem is step by step. And tonight I want to look at some common obsessions and show how they can be overcome with work and training. There are, in fact, only six major attachments: obsession with progress, obsession with pleasure, with stimulation, with views, with recognition or fame, and with fear of loss. Attachment to a wrong priority, such as these, persists only because of lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension. This is how it works. Suffering from lack of sense restraint and lack of mindfulness, we cannot see how one thing follows on from another in the mind. While we genuinely strive for what seems to us worthwhile, our lack of skill in seeing what is truly profitable means that we merely continue the same old patterns. To break the vicious circle of distress, indulgence, and more distress, we first of all need faith that the problem can be overcome. Usually, this means faith in the words of the meditation instructor who has successfully dealt with this very problem many times before. Of course, any instructor has also had failures. Some would-be meditators wrongly believe their problem is exceedingly rare and specialized. They will not accept that they suffer from the normal, ordinary difficulties, and when they do not get the special treatment they demand, they go somewhere else. The solution to the problem of hindering obsessions is straightforward, but needs very careful setting up. The following are not optional, they are an absolutely necessary foundation for success in meditation. There are six requirements in all. We have to observe the precepts. It's not optional, we have to do it. We must accept, intellectually, at least, mundane right view. And just quickly, that is that actions have results. There is a result of giving. There are mother and father. I don't propose to explain it at length now because I don't really have time. But basically it means we're fortunate to have human birth and we owe that to our parents. There are such things as spontaneously arisen beings on other planes of existence. And there are teachers who know about these things. We also must accept, intellectually at least, the Four Noble Truths. We have to, we must, systematically set up mindfulness. We must restrain the senses, and we must restrain mental indulgences and note the sequence of mental events. Those six things are imperative. Indeed, if they're not in place, nothing happens. So let's look at the individual obsessions. First of all, obsession with progress. I think we all know this one. We desperately want to get on. Typically, we cannot believe that less application will be more effective. And often we suffer from extreme discomfort or, alternatively, much sloth and sleepiness in the meditation. Excessive effort as such leads to seemingly constant great pain. Each meditation is a trial of endurance and the aftermath quite often a hell of despair and self-doubt. On the other hand, excessive concentration leads to much unconsciousness and or three-dimensional fantasy. We find we cannot stay awake and rational, and again the aftermath is despair and self-loathing. Let us suppose that we've been instructed not to try so hard, perhaps even to sit and to do nothing but watch. How do we get on? Typically, for the first few moments, the meditation is okay, although superficial compared with what we think of as normal. Doubts begin to arise. I could sit here all day doing this, getting nowhere at all. Perhaps I should just try looking at rise and fall a bit. We resist the temptation, but before long, give in and apply the mind firmly to rise and fall. Almost immediately, the tension arises, or if it's concentration, the sloth arises, along with self-hatred, despair, and assorted kinds of mental anguish. The initial task in overcoming obsessions is to see this sequence of events and to realize that when the effort is excessive, tension must result. Or when the concentration is excessive, sloth and sleepiness must result. Once we know through experience that we create the problem and that we do not have to, we are halfway home. It becomes obvious that with the correct balance of factors, the meditation has to work properly. Note well that this knowledge arises only if the six requirements are in place. Obsession with pleasure is slightly different. Those of us with attachment to pleasure believe that pleasant feeling is the highest good, and that unpleasant feeling is a sign of something very wrong. This is often an obsession of those who've never had to work hard and who do not accept that our lot as human beings is to work and to suffer. By always trying to avoid unpleasant feeling, we become tortured by pain and discomfort and our universe seems filled with nothing else. The solution is to learn about karma, about action and result, and to realize through that study that it is impossible to experience only pleasant feelings. Having senses, they will be impinged upon by things pleasant and unpleasant. It is unavoidable, so unpleasant feelings must arise. We should observe the transience of all feeling, pleasant and unpleasant alike. But also, quite aside from that, we should be impeccable about rule-keeping and time-keeping. And that, if you think about it, is to put oneself under a certain amount of stress and therefore to bring about unpleasant feeling, something that someone with an obsession about pleasure just does not want to do. We need to learn forbearance and patience, become stoical in our approach. And also, we need to practice sense restraint to discover the joy in being aloof from sensory impacts. But then we have to watch out that we're not seduced into not working because the calm is so delightful. The third obsession is obsession with stimulation. The attachment is to stimulation and agitation, mental busyness. We are too fearful of the void within to do nothing. We believe that doing something is preferable to inactivity, but paradoxically, most of us with this obsession claim we are not responsible for the mental activity and say that it goes on by itself. So we indulge ourselves in sensory and mental activity to escape from boredom and to provide the illusion of progress. We may experiment constantly with different ways of doing the meditation and get absolutely nowhere because we lack any focus. The solution is as follows. As before, and as with all of these problems, we have to see through mindfulness what we are doing to ourselves. Typically, with agitation, there is either poor sila, poor discipline, not keeping precepts, that kind of thing, which gives rise to a certain amount of guilty dread, or absence of faith or intelligence, which manifests as boredom with the profitable. For those of us with an obsession about agitation, stimulation, we need to learn about papancha, a Pali term meaning proliferation of concepts. It's something that everybody knows intimately, but probably has never taken much notice of. Essentially, you can multiply up concepts indefinitely. Start to worry about what's going on in the meditation, and you can spend the whole hour, days, weeks, months, years researching it. Indeed, it reminds me of an Indian chap who, before he started out on his spiritual search, thought he ought to do some research, and so went to a famous library and started looking up details of this or that practice. 50 years later, on his deathbed, he suddenly realized that he was still studying and hadn't come to the end of it and hadn't done anything practical at all. Proliferation of concepts. It's so easy, and so many of us do it. So we have to learn about that and also learn about how sense bases and sense objects relate, how things arise. We need, in the meditation, to include every occurrence of thinking as an object to be noted when we have this obsession. We need very much to practice sense restraint and mental restraint. It's perfectly possible to stop yourself thinking about things if you are determined. How many of you have been on holiday, have been having a lovely time, and about midway through, You suddenly think of home or work, and the heart sinks. What do? You resolutely refuse to think about it. You put it aside and carry on enjoying yourself. When it comes to meditation, it isn't quite the same, is it? I wonder why. And the other thing you can do if you've got this particular problem is follow instruction, even when that instruction is most unwelcome. The fourth obsession is with views, often shown as an obsession with intellect itself. In this case, we are attached to our own ideas about things and quite often argue vehemently, in some cases, with the instruction given. We are apt to hold forth in classes, to the embarrassment of all, and this conceit personally leads to much doubt and lack of faith. For those of us with this problem, it's always worth remembering that we asked to be taught. The solution is to try to put aside views and just practice as instructed. But a very useful thing to do also is to include as an object of meditation the arising of any view of one's own. It helps to ask genuine questions instead of merely disagreeing on principle. It is of enormous benefit to learn obedience to the instruction, compliance, and faith. And toward that end, it helps to practice metta, loving kindness. The fifth obsession is with fame or recognition. This is an attachment to position or an attachment to adulation as a major priority in life. This commonly leads to conceit, friction, refusal to keep the precepts, they couldn't possibly apply to me, plus constant attempts to deceive the meditation instructor about actual progress. Such an individual is apt to claim meditative states to which he or she is most definitely not entitled. The solution is before various, but it helps greatly to practice the resolution into elements. That is, to take any aspect of your experience, physical experience, and resolve it into components of earth, air, fire, and water, or hardness and softness, temperature and extension in space. And you'll be amazed at just how important that is in destroying the illusion that people position is important. We need to include any craving for recognition as an object to be noted in the meditation, not just fall into worrying about whether we're being recognized or not, but to just note that that thought has arisen. We need to accept any order or any task or any position we happen to be given, whether this is at work, in meditation, anywhere, in fact. It can help to practice sympathetic joy, in other words, to recognize, to feel good about somebody else's success, rather than envious that we haven't got it ourselves. And the other thing that helps greatly for obsession with recognition is to practice the perception of dukkha, of unsatisfactoriness. And the last one of the set is obsession with fear of loss. This is attachment to the status quo. It means that we resent change because we have to rethink things and adapt to new circumstances. It typically shows as an inability to let go of the past in any form. For the recluse, this might mean family relationships, past achievements, past interests. For the lay person, it's an inability to accept change, generally speaking, plus the adjustments to lifestyle and friendships that meditation demands. The solutions are various, but one very helpful thing is always to include in the meditation fear of loss when it arises as an object to be noted. Perception of transience is crucial to this one. Things do change. Everything changes, even at the most minute detail you can think of. Perception of dukkha and unsatisfactoriness is also extremely helpful, because we begin to realize that even though we may think the status quo is okay, looked at from another angle, it's quite unsatisfactory. We also need, I wondered whether to put this one in actually, but we also need to understand rules and the logic of decisions. That might sound a bit obscure, but if we decide to go one way and then certain things result from that, it's no good saying, oh, I wish I'd gone the other way, because you didn't. So to regret past decisions because of present circumstances is crazy. It's trying to exercise hindsight. And we all know that it doesn't work. All it can do is make you unhappy. The long and short of it is this. Any decision we made in the past was made to the very best of our ability at the time. It could not have been different. It's easy to look back now and say, well, if I'd known what I know now, I wouldn't have. But of course, you didn't. We didn't know then what we know now. So put in exactly the same circumstances, were that possible, we would make exactly the same decision again. So it's pointless to regret it, but many, many do. And so they say, oh, I wish I hadn't done this and I want to do that. If it's really that troublesome, all you have to do is make a new decision, change direction again. But I have seen people go around in circles. So that can help enormously. If you understand the rules of logic and the rules and the logic of decisions, it can help enormously to overcome that fear of loss. To summarize, there are six major obsessions that block meditative progress: attachment to progress, attachment to pleasant feeling, attachment to stimulation, attachment to views, attachment to fame or recognition, and attachment to fear of loss. These obsessions completely prevent any effective mental development, but can always be overcome. To succeed, the meditator must do certain things. He or she must observe the precepts, must accept, intellectually at least, mundane right view, must accept, intellectually to start with, Four Noble Truths, must systematically set up mindfulness, must restrain the senses, and must restrain mental interference and note the sequence of mental events. If these things are done, and not otherwise, the meditation must succeed. It cannot fail. We discover that just as we had the power to set up the habit in the first place, we have the power now to undo that obsession and to reach for freedom. Some believe that because it took 20 or 30 years to set up an attachment, it must take as long to overcome it. That is definitely not the case. The mind trained in mindfulness and clear comprehension is many times stronger than the mind which is not. Setting up the initial conditions takes a while, a few weeks or a few months perhaps. But after that, when you can see what you're doing, all it takes is care and application. While not easy, it is entirely possible to conquer hindering attachments and obsessions, no matter how bad they are. Once the wrong priorities, the six obsessions, are out of the way, then there is nothing to stop the meditation developing at the fastest rate possible. All meditators who correctly deal with the obsessions have every chance of coming to stream-winning at the very least. All can attain assurance of eventual enlightenment. If not within the near future, then certainly, for most, within this very lifetime. Thank you.